You're listening to Package Your Genius, a weekly podcast designed to give you clarity around your calling and serve as a catalyst for your career, your business, and your big dreams. I'm your host, Amanda Miller Littlejohn. Welcome back to Package Your Genius. Thanks so much for joining us. I am absolutely thrilled today to be in studio with our guest for the episode, who not only will be sharing some nuggets with us about ways that we can push past fear and really go for our dreams, but the guest that we have on today is someone who is very near and dear to my heart. She is a childhood friend who I recently reconnected with and am so excited that she's doing such big things in the world. Our guest today is Dr. Risha Moxley, and Risha received her PhD in counseling psychology from the University of Georgia. She earned her master's in human development counseling from Vanderbilt University before working in several clinical settings, including community mental health and university counseling centers, as well as a few public and charter schools. Dr. Moxley is currently a staff psychologist at Johns Hopkins University, and her therapeutic approach is primarily influenced by multicultural and feminist perspectives. Dr. Moxley's clinical and research interests include the multicultural training and development of mental health clinicians, as well as other social justice and diversity-related issues. Dr. Moxley, or Risha, as I have known her for more than half of my life, and I grew up together in the wonderful town of Nashville, Tennessee, and I'm so excited to have her today on the podcast. Welcome, Risha.
Good night, good morning, good early afternoon,
wherever you are and whatever time it is for you.
I'm so happy to be here. So proud of you, Amanda. Mandy, man. What are we talking about today?
Oh my goodness, Risha. Well, I want to talk about several things. I'm so excited to pick your brain because it's just really powerful to have a true mental health professional who can talk about the clinical aspects of what holds us back from going for our dreams. But before we dig into all of that, because we're going to dig, and I think as our listeners will soon see, we have a very interesting dynamic, the type of dynamic that only comes from knowing someone longer than you have not known them.
Don't say the number of years now. Don't put my business out in that street, girl.
Not putting any business out, not saying any numbers, but to have known someone longer than you have not known them, I think is very powerful.
So, oh, Amanda, you trying to get me to cry?
I'm not trying to get you to cry.
You know I'm a crier.
But Risha, tell us, or Dr. Moxley for our listeners, tell us a little bit about yourself, your work, and what you focus on, what you're passionate about in the realm of psychology.
You know, that is ever evolving. I got my start in community mental health, and my formative years in terms of training have been in counseling centers. So I do a lot of work with millennials. My particular passion is Black women, women of color, and traversing predominantly white spaces and finding counter spaces. And counter spaces are those particularly when you're in a predominantly white space, when you have your sister girls or your BG. So the BGC is a Black girls club. And that's typically in predominantly white spaces. And people out there know. So no matter where you go, it's almost like synchronized. There is a BGC. And these are women that get together in these counter spaces and have discussions about what sustains us in these predominantly white spaces that typically have not been formed for us.
Does that run parallel to that concept of Blavity that we heard about earlier today?
Actually, I think that is so on point. So on point.
For our listeners, earlier today, we attended a conference that was held and hosted by the media startup Blavity.com. And the idea of Blavity is Black gravity. So it's the idea that in those predominantly white spaces, when you find the Black people who are in the space, they all kind of gravitate. Yeah, they gravitate towards the center. They find each other. Mm-hmm. And it's like a gravitational pull of Blackness.
Absolutely. And you find that it's very necessary. But what I'm actually finding, which is really interesting, as younger people infiltrate these spaces, there seems to be less less of a need. So there's more of an enmeshment with the predominantly white spaces. And I think there is something being lost in that. But that's a whole nother topic, girl.
It's interesting because I was just about to say, wow, that must be good then if there's less of a need. But you're saying something is lost. So
I do believe that there's something lost. And we can talk about that. But maybe I'm old school.
Hey, no judgment either way.
Am I old enough? It better not be no judgment.
We're the same age. So you're not old school.
I'm 6 days older than you. Better not be no judgment, girl. Anyway, that's a whole nother podcast for a whole nother day. So you're going to have me back.
Consider it your invitation today back whenever we can absolutely have you. So this is something that has been on my mind for several years, actually. And I've touched upon this on the podcast when talking about the work that I do with my personal brand coaching clients. When people reach out to me during a period of transition, when they are ready to do something different, they're ready to assume a new identity and walk into a new phase of their lives. And they reach out to me because they kind of need, I'm almost like that Harriet Tubman taking them from slavery to freedom. You know, they need a guide. They need someone who can take them, help them cross over.
Absolutely.
And I'm honored to do that work and serve as that person who can hear your truth and hear what you're saying and mirror back to you the truth, your own truth, and help you see, you know, your path forward. But over the last 3 years or so, I've begun to really notice that despite the best intentions of the women, particularly, it's mainly women who have this issue.
Speak on it that
I come across, because when the men come to me and they want a strategy and a plan, they execute it and they're gone.
They're ready to go.
Ooh. But I find that women, they come to the table and they say they're ready for transformation.
Ooh, we getting into it.
But after having a strategy session or some sort of strategic discussion about what the next phase of their journey could look like, giving them a tactical plan that outlines what they are to do beginning today to get to that next phase. Many times I am conflicted and discouraged and...
Don't be diplomatic. Go on, keep it real, because we've talked about it. Okay, keep it real.
I'm frustrated when the prescription that I prescribe, they don't take it to the pharmacy.
So they just leave it and let it expire.
They leave it in the purse. They let it expire. It's like 6 months later, nothing.
Get stains on it.
The ink is rubbed off. It's no longer legible. It's useless.
Pharmacists can't even read the prescription. They can't read the script anymore. We're going to get into it. So you just about to get all up in the business today, huh?
I am. So my issue is, I get it. So I think what happened for me was I realized that beyond the tactical prescription of what should I be doing to get myself out there, to build my brand, to package my genius in a way that the world can consume it or digest it. People really need some sort of psychological push to help them get over the hump, the fear of stepping into that new identity.
Right.
And so I want to hear from you. What do you think it is that keeps especially women from moving forward when they have all of the information, all the tools that they need? They have everything at their disposal. Why don't they move forward to do the things they want to do and step into the women that they claim they want to be?
You know, at this point, we're going to be preaching to the choir. There could be so many underlying emotional issues that inform the hesitancy that you're seeing. But the homie Prochaska has done 20 years of research on this very thing, okay? And so he's come up with 5 stages of change. And so as the listener is engaging with us, I want you to really think about, as I list the stages of change, I want you to consider where you might fall. This is going to foreshadow, if you will, what might be the underlying issue. Okay, so Prochaska, back in 97 at least, came up with the stages of change.
And so, who is Prochaska?
He is an eminent researcher.
Okay, a psychologist?
Yes, psychologist, an eminent researcher in psychology. He's come up with 5 stages of change at all. I must say, it's not just him. Over the years, he's had certainly a lot of colleagues working with him. But the first stage is pre-contemplation. And that is when you're not yet acknowledging that there is a problem behavior that needs to be changed. I do believe the young people would probably, quote, Big Sean. So basically at this stage, they ain't thinking about you. Listen, so you might be, as an outsider and doing what you do so well, you might see that there needs to be a change. If people are outlining their goals and what they want for themselves in the future, when they're at the pre-contemplation stage, they don't see that they need to change their behaviors.
So what would make them reach out to not just me, but any coach and, you know, say, hey, help me do X, Y, and Z? What would make them reach out if they're not yet ready for change?
People in this stage would not be reaching out to you.
Okay.
So usually at this stage, people on the outside, concerned citizens,
Facebook fans,
they, if they even have fans at this point, they might have just people looking at their page to get the dirt, to get the
Facebook stalkers.
You know what I'm talking about?
Warriors.
Yeah. At this point, they're not really seeing that there is any issue at all. And so people at this stage wouldn't be reaching out to you at all. But that's the first stage. They ain't thinking about you. They're not thinking about packaging their genius. Okay. The contemplation stage is acknowledging that there is a problem. They're not yet ready or sure of wanting to make a change. So they're ambivalent. They're not sure if they know that there's a problem. They know where they want to go, but they're not yet sure if they're ready to do that yet. So this might be when people start looking at your website, looking at your presence online, and they might say, whoa, she's on to something, but I'm not yet sure if I want to reach that level yet. I'm not sure. So that's the ambivalence. And the next is preparation determination. This is when they're reaching out to you. This is when they are getting ready to make the change. Mm-hmm. So they're really kind of considering, you know, I've been in this slump. I think we've talked a little earlier about someone who may have been in this point. They're in a slump. They're really unhappy with the way things are going in their life, and they want to make a change. So they're preparing. This might be, and I've done this, Lord, no, actually, I don't know if I have. This is when you want to work out and you're like, you know what? I'm about to lay my clothes out the night before. You know what I mean? I'm about to turn that alarm on, and I'm not going to have my phone under my pillow. I have my phone on the other side of the room. I had to get up out that bed. I'm going to get up out the bed. I'm going to put the shoes on. That's the preparation. It's the night before when you're preparing to do something. And then the next stage is the action and the willpower. And this is a danger stage, because a lot of people try to make changes at this point and they go solely on willpower. In the field, they call it white knuckling. If you can imagine yourself sitting in a chair, if you're white,
and you're
wait, I don't know what you do if you're brown.
My knuckles don't turn white. Yeah,
yeah. Black, I don't know. Knuckle, maybe it, man, you gotta be knuckles. Gripping. I was thinking red, but you gripping hard. We got carpal tunnel issues to deal with at that point. But anyway, I digress. So at this stage, you're trying to make the change, but it's solely based on willpower. This is the shortest stage, and people think it's the most powerful, but it's really not. The amount of time people spend varies, but usually it lasts about 6 months, but it can be as short as an hour. And this is when you're like, I'm gonna do it. You grit your teeth. Maybe that's universal, gritting your teeth, right? So you're just like, I'm gonna do it. I'm gonna make sure it happens. And you develop plans to deal with, you think through everything. So you're like, man, I'm strategizing. I'm gonna figure out what I need to do, how I'm gonna make this happen. But I really caution you at this stage, because I think this is what happens with a lot of people that you work with. They're at this stage and it's really energizing initially because you're ready. You're ready. You're gritting your teeth. You're going to get out there and you're going to do it, but you don't have enough to sustain you yet. And so what happens at this stage? Well, let me go into stage 5, and that's maintenance. So maintenance is when you have a couple of things under your belt. You've done, so in recovery, it might be, you might be 2, 3 weeks, 6 months clean, and you have a history in the new behaviors. And so you're building up on that, and you really want to get to this stage. So it's really important to think about when you're at that willpower stage, know that each day is just as important as the next. So
what you're saying is we have to get some wins under our belt in order for us to be able to sustain the change. So the more quickly we can get some points up on the board, the more we can get that sensation of moving into the direction of who we want to be, the easier it will be to really assume that new identity.
Absolutely. Because the preparation and the willpower, they're heady combinations, because you've prepared and then you have that internal drive that you're going to really make this happen this time. But if you don't put that step forward, it, a lot of times what happens is that people have prepared, they have the willpower, and something happens right at the starting gate. Is that what they call it? Right at the, on the blocks when they're just the false start.
Right.
That's there what they is. Call it, girl. There I ain't is. Never ran track, but I watch it. You watch them gentlemen track. Running that track.
I've run track, sadly.
But yes. The false start. And it can be, even when you see it in the Olympic Games, even when you see people doing the fall, it's devastating, right? Because you can be DQ'd. You can be completely disqualified. You can work so hard, get to the Olympic Games, and you can be DQ'd right at that pivotal point.
And that can throw everything off.
And that throws everything off. The difference between people who are successful and people who are not is that people who do the false start is not the end of it. It's what you do after that. Are you so discouraged that you just don't hit the starting blocks again? Or do you hit it again and you keep trying? So that's the difference, is being okay with failing.
How do we build up our resistance to failure?
Well, we've talked a little bit about this, and it really depends on what you think failure is. So there's a difference between failure and being complacent. Mm-hmm. So a lot of people have in mind that failure means that you are on the verge of being evicted. So this is what people fear the most, that they will do something to put themselves out there, and that either people would judge them and say, that's stupid, or what is she trying to do? You have those friends or frenemies, and you hear them. There's a chorus running in your mind about what people will say when you try to make that next step. And so what happens is that can catch people up.
How do we build up our resistance to failure?
How you build it up is that you have to be okay with making the misstep.
You know, I think it's interesting. I ran into a young lady who I met last year at a conference. And when I spoke to her last year, she was telling me about a project that she was working on. And just from listening to her talk about the project, it was clear that she was not passionate about it. And I said as much to her then. And so running into her recently was really powerful, because she told me, or she gave me an update on that project and said that she did realize that she was only doing it because she had always done it and she wasn't passionate about it. It was something she needed to let go. But her new conundrum is that she's just not happy where she lives and she wants to relocate. And after I asked her and probed her, why was she not relocating? You know, did she have children or a husband or elderly parents that she was caring for? Like, what was keeping her rooted in that place? And she didn't have anything that was keeping her in that place. She was simply afraid to move and quote unquote fail. And so I told her, which I can be blunt, but I told her that, you know, if you have a vision for what you want your life to be, a very clear vision, because, you know, truthfully, so many people don't have a clear vision, but you have a very clear vision of what you want your life to be and you are not going after it, that is failure.
You know, it's interesting. You said that she didn't have anything demonstrably holding her back, that there was nothing, you know, no ties, no social ties keeping her rooted. But the chains of the things that people cannot see are strong. They have such a stronghold, and this can be generational.
So what are some of the things we can't see that hold us back?
So some of the things that can hold us back is the fear of judgment.
That's a big one. I see that so often.
And a lot of times people get caught up and they think that that's the only thing that's keeping them back. But if we peel back those layers, it goes a lot deeper than just fear of being judged. Sometimes it's about worthiness. Do you feel worthy enough to actually live your dreams? Mm. And people oftentimes don't get to that level because they get caught up in the social.
Right.
The social external aspect. Yeah.
Where does worthiness come from? Like, why is it that some people do feel worthy and they almost feel more worthy than they should feel? Mm-hmm. Whereas other people have imposter syndrome and feel like, you know, they don't deserve anything that they get. Like, How do those messages get mixed up in our heads?
Well, you talked about gender differences a little earlier, and that is
did
that
I?
Social.
That sounds so sophisticated. Did I say
you did indeed
gender differences?
Indubitably, you might not have said those words, but you know what I mean. You know, I got you.
You got me.
I got you.
You make me sound so smart.
We
I
go
like
back.
It, Dr.
We go
Moxley.
Back, boy. Listen. So you talked about that the gender differences earlier, and so there is a social component. The social construction of what women are willing to do or able to do or should do versus what men should do. And when you have a woman that's ambitious, then immediately she gets called the B word, or if in the field, she may be seen as narcissistic in some way. But men can be narcissistic in a way. I won't name someone who's running for president. We're not going to get political.
I just heard your Nashville come out.
I'm so
man.
Nashville. I'm man. So country, girl. You can take the girl out of the country. But anyway, where are you from?
A little town outside of...
Okay, then. So I digress. We digress. So what happens is that you get these labels about what it means to be ambitious. And that can be a tie.
I can admit that I struggle with that sometimes because I can be very direct. But I always feel a way about being too direct, especially around people I may not know or who may be working under me, because I don't want to seem I don't want to come off like a bitch.
And why not?
Because people don't like bitches. And then also there's the racial component. You don't want to be the angry black woman. Mm. But when you are frank and you are direct and you do have a very clear vision and clear ideas about what you want, sometimes you do feel the need to sugarcoat it and make it go down softer.
When you think about the angry black woman and the social construction of what it means to be an angry black woman, there's a deep irony at play there. And so if you are trying to avoid being the angry black woman, then you completely recede. You turn into yourself and you do not do the things you need to do to get things done. And so there's a really sick irony at play when you're trying to avoid being the angry black woman. What do you really get done? And so people see you in this unidimensional light, you know, that's typical. And so in an attempt to avoid that, you circumvent that and you actually may be shooting yourself in the foot. It's real. Yeah.
So as far as the people who are on the cusp, mm-hmm. people who are on the brink,
right?
You know they want to change. They have a strategy around that change. They have a vision for what the change could be. What would be your tips, your professional perspective, you know, coming from a medical, psychological, mental health perspective? How can they really prepare themselves for what might be an uphill battle of stepping into this new phase of life, embracing the fact that failure is pretty likely, maybe even inevitable, and just really bracing for the uncertainty of living life at a whole new level? What tips would you give to someone to just shore up that resolve so mm-hmm. that they can stay in the game and not be one of these people who I'm looking at saying, why aren't you acting?
Right. I think it starts with redefining what failure means, because we think that failure is universal, like the meaning of failure is universal. But there's conventional wisdom. What's the quote? Failure is really if you just decide not, you fall and you don't get back up again. Right. That's really when you fail. So I want each of you, all the listeners, to really think about. Now, I'll actually ask you, Amanda, what does failure mean specifically in your life? What would failure mean for you?
For me, that's a good question. Failure for me on a personal level would be me not giving my best effort. So for me, if things don't go my way, I have never felt bad. If I knew I laid it all on the line, I tried my best. I did all I could do. You know, back in the day, you're in school, like I was, you know, super ambitious in high school and took a million AP tests and was really into academics. And you win some, you lose some. And I remember when I would give my all, even if I didn't make, you know, a 100 on the test, when I was taking calculus, if I gave it my all and really, really try and just there was nothing left and I still didn't get it right, I didn't feel bad about that. I'm like, well, you know what? Maybe I've come to the end of my road with mathematics. But if I did not give it my all and I just kind of gave up, to me that's failure, because you never know. You never know what could be for you. And so for even the projects that I've done and the programs I've launched, the events I've hosted, even the clients I've had, if it wasn't necessarily a good fit, if I had given it my all, I'm fine with it not working out. But it's when I don't, or when I have not given it my 100% best effort and then things don't work out, I consider that a failure.
What you're describing is the difference between resignation and resilience, okay? Double RR, you're resilient as a mofo. I won't curse today. But resiliency is how, yes. So if you resign yourself to trying your hardest, and I would even take it a step further. Let's say you put your all on the line and you don't have anything left and you fail, or you do what's perceived as fail. You come out of the blocks. What is it? You too soon. Yes, the false start. If that's the end of your story, you're done. So you've resigned yourself to actually failing.
I actually have a track analogy. When I was in the seventh, eighth, ninth, I don't know. At one point I had these dreams of being a track star, because in high school, do you remember this? Like way back when the faster you could run, the cooler you were?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
I wanted so desperately to be able to run fast. And it was like all the other black girls could run so fast. And I was such a nerd. And I remember I would read and I would research track stars, Olympic. And I was like, what is it about all? What's the similar? What are the common threads of all world-class Olympic athletes?
Resiliency.
And I started to know. I was like, oh, wow. It's not just that they have strong thighs and strong legs. They also seem to have strong upper body strength. So maybe I should start doing push-ups. Like I was into the science of speed. Like, how do I get faster? I had the best cleats. I mean, everything. And I remember I had a track meet. The coach, I don't know why she did it. It's funny because the track coach was a childhood friend of my mom's. And I know she knew I was slow. But for whatever reason, she put me in the 100 meter dash, which is, that's the fastest of the fast.
That's a short stop. You got to come out the gate.
I mean,
full speed ahead.
I was in a meet for my school and I had practiced. I was sore from practicing. I was taking it so seriously. I was so passionate about this. Like, I just knew, like, if I try, because I had pretty much been successful at anything I had tried my best at, right? And because that was limited to academics, to arts, that sort of thing. And I remember it was the day of the track meet. I go down for my event, you know, we're all lined up, and I go into the block, they shoot the gun or whatever they do. It was like a high school track meet. I don't think they had a gun.
A pistol starter guy.
They had something.
A little idea gun, a little idea gun.
Signaled, yeah, it's time to run. Mm-hmm. And literally, in my head, I'm thinking, okay, so when you come out, you're going to go right and then left and then right and then left and this, and you're going to, and you know, make sure you pivot off. I mean, everything. I'm thinking, I'm intellectualizing running, which is so stupid when you think about it.
I don't know.
Now. But the pistol goes off and it was like, I'm intellectualizing right, left. I'm starting to go. And within 10 seconds, the race was over and I was still like halfway down the track.
First of all, the 100 meter, that was not your race.
It was not my race.
Because you have to get out of your head in that one.
Oh,
you have
my
to.
God,
that's the natural
girls
instinct.
Girls shot out of there. We're down at the end of the track.
They went
about still. I mean,
right, left, right, left on into the car, girl. Track meet over, girl. Lights done turned off and everything.
Awful.
Listen,
it was awful, but look, yes, I felt like a failure briefly. Real failure in your life. Think back on it as a memory. I don't really think of that, my track career, my short-lived track career, as a huge failure, because I really did try my best. I can't feel bad about how I did.
Right.
Because I took, I left all, I didn't have much, but I left what I had on that track.
And you know what was highlighted in that story? And this is when you have to have gifted coaches, gifted teachers to let you know running ain't your ministry.
I realized that.
That's not your ministry, boo. But you are gifted. It's just not on that. It's not. That's not your ministry. But what you demonstrated in that story is that you have a mind for things and that you are thinking through things to the 10th power.
I wanted it so badly, Risha.
Listen, and so you might not get the track thing. You won't, boo. It's over. But listen, you don't have to be resigned to. So what happens a lot of times, if that's your dream, that's your pre-best, that's your dream as you're hitting puberty and you're seeing the muscles on the track. I'm getting caught up. I'm getting caught up in the muscles. Listen. So you that's your dream, right? And you put it all out on the field and you fail. If you don't dare to dream or you don't figure out, well, what is it that in this process, what did I learn? It can be the difference between resigning yourself. I couldn't meet this dream. So I might as well just forget it. I'm not good at anything. I just resign myself to not try at anything, because that failure, or what can be perceived as a failure in that moment, can be enough to suspend people for the rest of their lives. But what you demonstrated in that moment is that you have a mind for things, you think through things, and that is not necessarily going to help you on the track field, but it will help you package some genius.
I agree.
Hello, and somebody.
I agree.
A word from our sponsors.
No, I thank you for that. And as we close, I just want to say, I've never thought about that experience in that way before. I remember thinking back on my track career, short-lived as it was, and having not a sense of failure, but kind of a sense of embarrassment. Like, wow, I remember the feeling of being on the track, and it was kind of humiliating to be literally the, like, not even the slowest, but not even, like, within range of the slowest person. Like, everyone else, you know, he's like, oh, I'm a couple of seconds behind. I was like a full minute behind the last person who, it was
our producer
sad.
Is laughing. I gotta reframe for you.
But just 20 years later, thinking back to that, I am so proud of her.
Absolutely.
Because, you know, what if I had never gotten out there? I get it. It's not my ministry. But if I hadn't at least tried that, like, I would never have the nerve to do that today.
And that's what
I'm proud of her for.
And you should be.
Having done that.
And you should be.
So that's not a failure.
It is not. Indeed, it is not. And what I would say to all of the people who are still on the field, the lights are being turned off. The janitor coming in asking you, are you okay, baby? Listen, it may be that that's not your field. If you're still, ooh, that'll preach, won't it? My Southern Baptist roots. That was my whoop.
You're supposed to let the congregation tell you you're
Listen,
preaching.
Listen, that's
Risha.
My right.
Well, you can't tell yourself you're preaching.
You late. Give me my rag.
I
need my James Brown cape. Listen here. We're wrapping up. But listen, if you're still on the field and no one else is there, perhaps you need to reconfigure where your field is.
Drive across town.
Listen, the race may be over. Their race is over, but yours has just begun. I might have to leave on that.
I think we should leave on that. That was
Listen,
good. Risha, Dr. Moxley.
Risha E. Moxley. I'd be remiss not to throw that E in there.
But this was an absolute treat. A joy, a pleasure, and I look forward to having you back on Packager Genius to talk more about ways we can push through our fears and step into the women and men for our men listeners.
Absolutely.
That we know we are meant to be, because I know, I've been doing this long enough to know that it's not just about having a plan, a roadmap, a tactical roadmap of what to do, but you really do have to conquer and slay those internal dragons before you can really see any results. And
absolutely.
So, I think the work that you're doing is tremendous. I'm excited to see you as a fresh new voice for
Boop.
Women like me and like our listeners. And I'm excited to see where your research goes, where your work goes, and also your involvement with Packager Genius Academy.
I am so excited about it. I am, indubitably. And I'll leave the listeners with this. Just think about the difference between resignation and resilience. And whenever you're in doubt, whenever you're really just questioning yourself, consider what line you're going to draw. and always lean towards the resilience. And that is never saying never. In the face of defeat, just recognize that the field may change. You may have needed all the other runners to clear out because the field is changing before your very eyes. Be resigned to be resilient.
Yes. Love it. Absolutely. Be resigned to be resilient, everyone. If you'd like to learn more about Dr. Risha Moxley's mental health services, she is a practicing therapist based in the Baltimore, Washington, D.C. area, but she is accepting private clients. Feel free to reach out to her at risha.moxley@gmail.com. That's risha.moxley@gmail.com. Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Package Your Genius. Please make sure to subscribe to us on iTunes and Stitcher, and download as many episodes as you possibly can on your device, because that helps us grow and reach a wider audience. And do me a favor and share this episode with someone you know who is struggling to push past their own fear. Thank you for joining us on Package Your Genius. We'll see you next week.